The Cosmo with Scott De Butler on RTE Pulse in association with Gaystar News. For all your LGBTI news, gaystarnews.com.
You are listening to The Cosmo with myself, Scott Butler, here live on RTE Pulse. Now it's time for us, It's time for us to head over to London to get the latest in LGBT news. And I'm delighted to have on the phone from London, Tris Reid-Smith, the editor of Gaystar News. Tris, you're very welcome along.
Lovely to be with you again.
Listen, we have got some really interesting stories this week. One we touched on last week, and two are definitely a bit more humorous. Anyway, we'll start off with the slightly more serious story for this week, though. We discussed Brunei before, and things seem to be getting a bit more serious as the days go by there.
Yeah, what's been happening is the Sultan of Brunei has announced that they're going to start imposing Sharia law. And they'll do that in three phases. During the first phase, they'll be putting in fines and prison sentences for various crimes. In the second phase, they start amputations for stealing. And in the third phase, they'll be stoning for sexual crimes, which include gay sex, in that third phase. Obviously, this has been mooted before in the last few weeks. There's been intense international pressure, but he's chosen to ignore that. And this small country in Southeast Asia is going completely the opposite direction of every other country in that region, and going back to the Dark Ages, really, in a quite terrifying way for anybody who lives there. So that is, it's sort of slightly disempowering, for a lot of people who want to try and fight it. We know that he owns part of the Dorchester Hotel Group. People have called for boycotts of that, including Stephen Fry and Ellen DeGeneres. But, you know, beyond that, what do normal people do about it?
Well, this is the thing, that there was another story that went out recently as well, to do with the Beverly Hills Hotel, because the Sultan, as far as I know, wholly owns the hotel in California. So, it's very strange that, while boycotts are taking place on one side of the world, obviously back in Brunei, it doesn't seem to be making much of a difference. But, I think it probably should be, reminded to most people here that it isn't just, anti-gay laws that are taking place here as well. Like, there are some horrific things that are being suggested, or not even suggested, they're going to be implemented in terms of, theft, as you had said, about limbs being cut off, to adultery and everything else. Like, surely there must be some sort of support for people in Brunei that are able to say, hold on, this is getting ridiculous. Is this a hopeless case, do you think?
Well, there is pressure from the United Nations. There is pressure from, big organisations like Amnesty International. And we can only hope that countries in that region will lead the pressure, because if it's seen as coming only from sort of the West, in inverted commas, I think that it's less likely to be successful. But if it comes from other Muslim countries like Malaysia, which, is part of that region as well, like Indonesia, if it comes from places like that, which sort of share borders, that might be more effective in a way than it coming only from Europe and America and so on. We need to rally and get the right people talking about this. But we also need to maybe have something which is a bit more strenuous against Brunei than just sort of people saying, well, we don't want to sit next to you in the UN. It's got to be a more concerted attack on this injustice.
Yeah, very, very true. Well, I guess we've seen similar sanctions being taken place, on the likes of Russia. Obviously, not necessarily for anti-gay laws, although obviously that would be quite connected with Russia as well. It's a very, very strange case, and it seems to be that every time we seem to be talking about this, the situation in Brunei is getting worse. So I dread to think what we'll be talking about the next week we talk about this, Tris, but no doubt we'll be keeping an eye on it, and so will Gaystar News. Let's move on to something that is a bit lighter. Back in the UK, a study was done that showed that 93% of straight guys have spooned another fella before.
Yeah, this is a survey of young straight men in the UK. 93% of them have cuddled up with one of their friends in bed. And actually, 98% have shared a bed with one of their male friends. It shows there's maybe a shift in morality, maybe a shift in the way guys are treating each other. Back in the day when I was growing up, a handshake was considered quite intimate. Now, you know, nursing a hangover while you're cuddling each other seems to be de rigueur, so which is quite sweet, really, isn't it?
Well,
you know, it's, and why not?
Well, in some ways, I had to laugh at that, the idea of the handshake being the most intimate thing. That sounds like a very traditional British type of intimacy. But it is really strange. I think one of the things we need to make clear here as well, though, is that the study was conducted with 40 straight guys in a particular university. So it isn't necessarily the most... you know, far-reaching of studies, you know, for these 40 guys.
It's a very small survey size. What I guess it is, I mean, I think it shows an interesting area where we can look and do some more studies. But it does show that there's maybe a different, and how they recruited those people. There's always, you know, scientific questions you can ask about that. But it does show that there's maybe, you know, some interesting social trends and maybe a softening of people's view about how they should be. And maybe a greater comfort with people's own sexuality, that they don't feel that cuddling a friend or hugging a friend when you see them, and actually people are much more likely to hug each other you know, when they meet than I think they used to be. And
yeah,
I think that people have realised that that doesn't mean that they're not straight, so I think that there's a nice shift there.
Yeah, either way, it probably does show, or at least it hints at a change in culture amongst the youth. Oliver in London has just texted in, and he says, I've shared a bed with another guy, but just top and tailed. Was this study done at Brighton University? I hear they cuddle a lot. Therese, whereabouts was this done?
I actually don't know. I'll have to look into that and get back to you on that.
As far as I know, from looking at the reports here, I don't think it was to do with Brighton, despite any rumours that Oliver may have heard.
No, it was done by scientists in Winchester and Durham, but which universities exactly they were surveying people, I couldn't tell you.
Right, okay. Well, maybe Oliver is onto something anyway. Let's move on to another bit of news that I have to admit, I broke my heart last. This was a Mormon study which asked you, are you heterosexual or are you heterosexual? Tell us a bit more.
Yes. It was a Mormon study about sexual orientation and the attitude of a new generation to that. But like you say, rather than asking you, are you gay or are you straight, they asked, to tick these boxes, I am heterosexual but I struggle with same-sex attraction. Or, I am heterosexual and do not struggle with same-sex attraction.
That's a very strange description.
After a few days, they decided to add, I consider myself homosexual, bisexual, transgendered. Why transgendered is suddenly a sexual orientation rather than a gender identity slightly passes me by, but obviously they aren't experts on this subject. And then they shifted the survey again. I would say, what do you learn from this? The Mormon Church, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, isn't so much as in Utah as it is in denial, I guess. yes, I think that they realise now that they've been a bit silly.
Yes.
I think that it's a shame, because actually the issue, while you can joke about it, and it is funny, the issue that gay, lesbian, bisexual Mormons face is a very great one. As is actually transgender, intersex Mormons, of course. And the oppression they face is very very worrying, and it's a shame that that church is not moving forward and there's ramifications on real people's lives. So hopefully, despite the botch they made to the survey, they'll learn something interesting from it and they will start to consider softening their views.
Yeah, well, I guess either way, it does show that there is a small little step towards progress. Maybe there were a few trips along the way towards that step, but still, it is showing hopefully some sort of a positive sign. Therese, of course, for all these stories and more, people can go on to gaystarnews.com. But in the meantime, thank you very, very much for coming on to the show. I should also say as well, I was desperately trying not to laugh earlier, because when you were talking about the UN saying to either Brunei or indeed Russia, you can't sit with us, it is the 10th anniversary today of Mean Girls, so that instantly popped into my head, I'm afraid.
Yeah, amidst much international celebration as well.
Absolutely. So it was very timely, if nothing else. Listen, in the meantime, Therese Reid-Smith, editor of Gaystar News, thank you very much for coming on to the show.
RTE Pulse.
The Cosmo with Scott the Butler. Radio for Ireland's gay and lesbian community.
You're listening to The Cosmo with myself, Scott Butler, here on RTE Pulse. Now, continuing on with our Pink Vote series, where we interview openly LGBT candidates ahead of the local and European elections. In studio with me for this evening, I have Councillor Pádraic McGoughan. He is a councillor for Dublin City Council with the Labour Party. I'm delighted to have him in studio with me at the moment. Pádraic, you're very welcome along.
Thank you very much.
So for those who might not necessarily know of you, who might not be living in your constituency, tell us a bit about you first and how you got involved in politics.
I'm a scientist. I live in Stony Batter in Dublin 7. I've lived in Dublin for 7 years now. I got involved with the party almost as soon as I moved up to Dublin. I just kept running into people from the Labour Party everywhere, and it's a very active constituency, so yeah. I liked the sound of the party, so I joined and got involved in local issues almost as soon as I moved to Dublin. Yeah. And then kept working in the party, and eventually... 2 years ago was co-opted to replace Seymour Costello on Dublin City Council when she became an MEP.
Right, okay. So this is going to be the first time that you'll be running for election in that case.
Yes, it is.
Excellent. Okay, so that's going to be a really exciting time for you.
It's quite an exciting time. Yeah. It's obviously well into the campaign now, which I suppose in one way started 2 years ago.
Yeah, true.
But it's fascinating, and it's a great experience, if nothing else.
So, as I had said earlier, you know, we're interviewing openly LGBT candidates for this interview series. Obviously, that does include yourself. And we had said before we went on air that you had came out before you joined the Labour Party. So, yeah. I guess from the very start, you've been an openly gay politician.
Pretty much. There's never been issues.
Yeah,
there really hasn't. It's not a party that there's any issues around LGBT candidates or LGBT members.
And I guess the Labour Party is one of those parties in Ireland that has a very, very good and very public track record of supporting LGBT rights. So did you feel that because you were gay yourself that the Labour Party was a good choice, or was it kind of independent of your own sexuality?
It did play a factor, all right. Okay. But there was so much more to it than that as well. I mean, it's not a one issue party. So, I mean, well, one of their policies suits me very much. All of their policies are very good, as far as I'm concerned.
Excellent. All right. Very good. Now, during your time on Dublin City Council, you know, as you said yourself, you've been looking after local issues as well as issues that will be closer to your heart, such as LGBT. But one of those was that, you know, a while ago here on the show, we were covering the fact that many different local councils were passing motions of support in terms of marriage equality. Now, on a legislative basis, it didn't really mean too much, but it was a sign of support. Do you think it had much of an impact?
I think it has an impact when you see it. I know it can seem futile when you have councils all around the place passing motions that don't really mean anything. But we do it all the time on other issues as well.
Right.
And it's our way of making our voice heard. I mean, there's a policy section to every council meeting. We get through that, we discuss that. Then there's emotions, which aren't always something we have an influence over directly, but it gives that voice that needs to be given. It sets out our beliefs clearly on a public stage. And I think from that point of view, it was a worthy motion to have passed. And I think it's great to see it passing in councils around the country. It's fairly obvious that it was going to pass in Dublin, but it's great to see areas outside Dublin where people would probably be saying, "Ah, sure, that's all up in Dublin that you do that sort of thing." And it's great to see supporting those councils for people who might be more isolated than anyone in Dublin is.
Very true. And I guess, you know, the fact that you said that it was showing your voice or using your voice in some ways, despite the fact that it is part of a local authority. There's something a bit more recent rather than just marriage equality that's going to be coming up in terms of Russia. Tell us a bit about this.
So this was a motion proposed by one of our independent councillors. It was a motion, a very worthy motion, critical of homophobia in Russia and issues pertaining to that. The one problem I had with that motion was that it also called essentially for what I saw as censorship of the Hulin Gallery in a Russian, in terms of a specifically named Russian exhibition. And I thought that it was too negative a track to take on it. And I think it fed a little into jingoism that I was uncomfortable with at the moment.
Okay, and what exactly do you mean by that?
Well, in terms of, I mean, I don't think anyone supports what Russia is doing in the Crimea at the moment, but I think we need to avoid being the Skibbereen Eagle again.
Okay. I have absolutely no idea what that means.
Okay.
Sorry.
It's a famous newspaper from the early 20th century, local Kerry newspaper with the headline, "The Skibbereen Eagle warns the Tsar that it has its eye on him."
Now, okay, right. Okay. I'm fair enough.
Of course, the joke being that, you know,
it was such a small paper.
It was such a small paper. I'm sure the Tsar at the time had more to worry about. And I'm sure there are more constructive things,
right,
constructive ways of dealing with homophobia in Russia than just an exhibition in the Hule. Essentially,
singling out an issue.
Singling out an event, and I think crossing the line into the management of the Hulane that we really shouldn't be crossing. If we do it for this, should we be criticising them for an art exhibition that I just don't like?
That's understandable.
That's one of the issues that I would have with that. So I instead put forward an amendment to that motion, which reflects the spirit, I think, of the motion, and also brings to the fore the EU roadmap against homophobia, which was agreed in the European Parliament.
Right.
And we're waiting for the European Commission, to ratify it as part of EU policy. And that's a place where Ireland has a voice, and it's a place where the EU should have a role, because it's not just Russia that there are homophobic attacks and policies. It's creeping in across Europe. And we need to be one of the countries that stands up and says that one of the core ideals of the EU is gender equality, and that includes equality across sexual preferences, across all the grounds of equality at its broadest, and that's what we should be standing for as European citizens.
Well, it's definitely personally something that I would agree with, you know, but on both a local and then maybe even a European level, considering we've just mentioned it, and these are the two types of elections coming up, do you think that both local councils and then on a European level, do you think that there's more that that the councils can do in terms of LGBT rights, or is it something that should be left to a national and European level?
Well, I think it's something that has to be done at every level.
Okay.
It's whether it's as small a level as in the workplace, in every single workplace, at every single council, there should be policies in place. For instance, Dublin City Council is very strong in its support for the various Pride events.
Yeah, very true.
And it's fantastic to see that in the city, and it's also the kind of thing that we're sometimes too quiet about. For instance, if you look at promotions of Dublin City, maybe we should be promoting the second biggest festival in the city in a year a little bit more as a key event rather than a niche event.
Very true. No, go ahead. Yeah, sorry.
Because it's the second biggest event in the city after St. Patrick's Day. And it attracts the second highest amount of visitors after St. Patrick's Day. And yet, you have to look very hard for it outside of niche publications.
Yeah, this is very, very true. But is it something that is possibly to do with, you know, changing a cultural perception of it? Do you know what I mean? As in a sense of maybe just the Irish aren't used to the fact that actually, do you know what? This is bringing in not only money into the city because, as you said, it's the second largest event, but, you know, it's not just... it doesn't need to be just a particularly a gay issue. It could be something that the entire city can embrace.
Yeah, well, I think the entire city does embrace it. Some institutions very much so. But I think it's just we need to remind people that there isn't this sort of divide between Irish and gay. And it's something, of course, that comes up every year in New York for the St. Patrick's Day Parade.
Good point, yeah.
And this is, it's the kind of, it's one of the things that there is still that troubling attitude, even in Dublin, that, you know, it's not quite Irish.
Right, you
know, okay.
it's almost something else.
It's not quite like the rest of us. And, you know, we just need to tackle that issue, and that's something that can be tackled at council level, it can be tackled at government level, and it can be tackled at European level.
Very good. All right, now, obviously, we were mentioning earlier that this is going to be your first time contesting the elections. Obviously, it's keeping you busy so far anyway.
Very busy, very busy.
Very busy. Yep. And for those that are in your constituency, obviously this is the time to talk about, you know, why they should be voting for you if they've only, you know, just come across you, or they possibly are fairly new to the area. Why should they be voting to keep you in council?
Well, I suppose I've tried to deliver as much to the area as possible over the last 2 years. I've worked with everyone possible to do that. I'm at the moment working with the Lord Mayor and other councillors on initiative in derelict sites, and for that is one of the core areas chosen to look at. That is all of the sites along the Lewis Red Line from Houston to Connolly.
Very good.
And that's that's a huge issue, and I think personally that ties in very nicely to the issue of housing in the city. Now, we have a huge amount of derelict sites, and we have a huge housing crisis brewing, and brewing rapidly, and maybe there's a solution there between those two.
Possibly, yeah.
So
excellent. All right, well, look, we'll leave it at that for the moment. Padraig McLaughlin of the Labour Party, you are contesting for the local elections for Dublin City Council in the North Inner City Ward. Best of luck. And hopefully we'll be chatting to you soon.
Thank you very much again.
RTE Pulse.
The Cosmo with Scott the Butler. Radio for Ireland's gay and lesbian community.
You're listening to The Cosmo with myself, Scott the Butler, here on RTE Pulse. Now, once a month, we usually have a section to talk about sexual health and awareness. And I'm delighted to have in studio with me at the moment, Dr. Shay Keating. Shay, you're very welcome along.
Thank you very much, Scott.
Shay, we were chatting just a few minutes before we went on air about something that I have to admit I had never heard about before, but this is a very worrying trend that is taking place amongst gay men in the UK, and it seems to be raising its head here in Ireland by the name of slamming. This is very, very alarming for yourself as a sexual health expert. Maybe you could explain for us why.
Okay, well, first of all, my two areas of interest would be hepatitis and HIV, or sexual health and HIV. And now we're seeing a bit of an overlap in the gay community, which is exceptionally worrying. Now, just to explain what slamming means, or what the whole notion of slamming. If you can imagine, there are certain chemicals that people would use to enhance their sexual activity. And if you use those orally, it's one thing, but if you actually are to inhale them, but now there's a fashion for actually injecting the drugs. And the chemicals are used during what they say chem sex would be crystal meth. They could use G.
Okay.
And there are a few popular drugs that they would use. But the problem that we have is that if you're going to inject a drug, there's a theoretical risk that if you share a needle, or sorry, there's no theoretical risk, it's a very big risk, if you share a needle or a syringe with somebody who's already used that injected with that needle and syringe, so the possibility that you could acquire a virus. And probably the commonest virus you'd get from injecting drug use at the moment would be hepatitis C.
And obviously, you know, again, before we were coming on air, this is something that seems to be quite, it seems to be a big problem in the UK. Why has this come about all of a sudden, or is there any background behind it?
To be honest, I don't really know why it's come out all of a sudden, but the reality is we're kind of, I think part of the reason is we're getting a little bit complacent about HIV. We know that HIV is becoming a very treatable entity, and more people who are HIV positive are being very, very, kept very, very healthy on the appropriate medicines. So I think the whole death sentence is gone, and people are out there partying again, and the risk of getting HIV seems to be, you know, is kind of taken out of the equation, because people realise the worst case scenario is they become infected, but the best case is it could be completely treated. So if you can imagine, people are out partying again, and I think more and more we like to try different things. You know, we start off with cannabis, maybe we might smoke cigarettes or alcohol or whatever, they move on to cocaine, but now there is a big trend in the UK for injecting the drugs, and like everything in the UK, unfortunately it seems to cross over the water and eventually happens over here. So we've been seeing over the last couple of years in the UK, in Europe, in North America, that in the gay community there's an increase in hepatitis C, and there's always been a notion that it's from sex. Hepatitis C is not very it's not acquired that easily through sex, but it's certainly possible, and it's probably more likely that it's actually due to injection drug use. And again, as I mentioned earlier, people are using needles and syringes and they're sharing with other people. And if they've got hepatitis C, it's no brainer that they're going to just pass it on to somebody else. Mm. Now, if I were to go into the drug community in Dublin, the heroin injection community, and if I were to ask a group of drug users, where would they access sterile needles and syringes, I can guarantee that to a man or to a woman, they would tell you exactly where to go. Mm. They'd know exactly where the needle exchange programs were. They'd be fully informed of how to use the needles and syringes appropriately. Yeah. But if I did the same on the gay scene in Dublin, I'm guessing that most people would not know where to access clean needles and syringes.
Yeah, probably.
So if you can imagine, people are injecting in, you know, these long, protracted episodes of sex that can go on for 2 and 3 days. And these stimulants, these obviously enhance sex. They can keep it going for a lot longer.
And dear God.
Yeah, exactly. So they're going to be injecting these drugs, and I can guarantee that they're just going to use the needles that are available there and then in the house. They're not going to come readily prepared.
That is absolutely horrific. Mm. You know what? It might be too much of a big question, but what can be done about this? Obviously, the very first one that comes to my mind is don't do it. But, you know, I guess there's a lot of people that aren't going to be that simple about this type of situation.
I mean, obviously some people actually like living on the edge, they like taking drugs, and that's a personal choice. Mm-hmm. So it does, there's no doubt about it, the chemicals will enhance their sexual activity, but the come down is very bad. Like a year later when they can't get an erection,
that's going that's to be the main problem for them.
They're going to end up with serious, and then they literally will not be able to have sex without the chemical.
Right.
The chemicals to help them function, so it's a real worry. But like every part of sexual health, or HIV, or hepatitis C, the most important thing to do is to educate people.
Right,
and if you teach people, give them the appropriate messages, well, then maybe they can protect themselves against hepatitis C.
But this is a strange thing. I guess I can't really talk about many cities in the UK because personally I wouldn't know too much. But, you know, we've discussed previously on this show about cities like Vancouver that, you know, might be able to give you, say, for example, clean syringes or kind of packs, I guess, to people that, you know, if it's, say, a club that's, you know, that's known to kind of have this type of drug being used around or this type of activity, that, you know, there's almost preparations put in place beforehand, before people go into the club. In Dublin, or even in other clubs in Ireland, you know, that type of culture isn't really here. So, do you think this is an issue that the LGBT community, or maybe just health services in general, need to start tackling?
Well, obviously the services are available in the injection drug using community.
Yeah.
Those who would abuse heroin or cocaine. So they do get little packs,
right.
And the packs would contain the needle, sterile needle and syringe, and they'd have small little like a little metal spoon for cooking up their heroin, etc. So we routinely give those out to drug users when they access our needle exchange programs. So the precedence is there, obviously, in the drug using, in the heroin using community. But I'm guessing that not in the not too distant future we're going to have to do the exact same thing in gay clubs and gay saunas. So we're going to make these sterile needles and syringes available to patients, or sorry, I beg your pardon, to people.
Right. So, but I guess in the meantime, you know, the risks of this type of activity really need to be made very, very clear, especially if this is a new type of trend that many people might not really be used to right away in Ireland. And you said that the risk of Hep C and obviously other types of illnesses will be very, very high here.
Absolutely. And obviously, if you're using drugs that are anyway intoxicating, and that I'm sure that's the reason people use them in the first place, you're going to be much more disinhibited. So their inhibitions are going to be down, going to be more likely to, obviously, to use drugs in an unsafe manner. Mm. They're going to be more likely to have unsafe sex. So not alone are you potentially getting hepatitis C from drug use, but you might be getting syphilis or gonorrhea or chlamydia just from casual sex. So it's really, really important that we make ourselves aware that this is a potentially big problem, and it's coming our way in the not too distant future. Now, hepatitis C is very, very treatable, but I mean, who wants it? Who wants another infection?
Yeah.
And obviously, the combination of hepatitis C and HIV have its own clinical problems from a doctor's point of view, and they can be difficult to treat in combination.
Right, okay, well, listen, we will leave it at that for the moment. Dr. Shay Keating, thank you very, very much for coming into the show tonight.
You're very welcome.
And
thank you very much.
For more information from Dr. Shay Keating, you can visit stdclinic.ie.
The Cosmo with Scott De Butler on RTE Pulse in association with Gaystar News. For all your LGBTI news, gaystarnews.com.